Porn in the library? Dangerous tech in the classrooms? 2, 4, 6, 8, what makes a sentence great? What now, teachers' unions? Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From Slate.com, art teacher in Utah fired after showing students classic paintings containing nudity. An elementary school in Cache Valley, Utah fired an art teacher after claiming that students became uncomfortable by postcards that depicted classical paintings, a few of which contained nudity. One parent even called the police, accusing the teacher of showing the students pornography.
Well,
100-year-old pornography.
Well, hey, look, how do you know it's pornography? I know it when I see it.
Exactly.
Right? That's the definition.
That's how it's gauged.
Oh,
yep.
What a story here, though. I mean, the teacher, Mateo Rueda, or Ruda, depending on how you're looking at it, though, was fired. Fifth grade teacher takes her class, doing a look at the intricacies of color, mm-hmm. goes into the school library.
The teacher does.
The teacher takes the kids into the school library mm-hmm. to look at art and goes through these postcards, these classic paintings, the kids. These things are already in the library,
mm-hmm.
okay? And comes across a few classic paintings, such as the iris tree, the brown odalisque, the Valpicon bather. And guess what? There's a little bit of bum, a little bit of boob in these, and some of the parents got really freaked out because their kids came home and talked about it.
These were already in the library. The teacher didn't plant these to say, hey, look, they're here.
Right. I'm going to purposely show you nudity.
Right.
Okay?
So we'll go to these 16th century
right.
postcards.
So the reality is that this teacher got fired. And if you dig deeper into this story, you find out that this went through three phases. First, the teacher was called in by administrators and given a 1-day suspension. Okay. Then brought in the next day and said, write this apology letter. You did wrong. You're going to be suspended for 2 days. And then that'll be the end of it, right?
Then you're done, yep.
But then we go back to the beginning of the story. One parent came in and said, this is pornography. And at the pornography parent, guess what, poor art teacher?
You're fired.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
The reality. So this is a problem, though, when you start thinking about this. And according to the teacher, whether you're looking at truly studying art, nudity has always been a part of art.
It has been, yeah.
You know, and so especially when you're looking at these classic paintings. So, mm-hmm. again, we've got a real problem here when you start saying when teachers, what they're up against, the reality of teaching for deep meaning and really digging deep. Here's a teacher that actually was using appropriate materials that were in the room already, did mm-hmm. not select them, and still lost their job. Okay? Looking at classic paintings, calling them pornography, I think we have a parent problem and not a teacher problem.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Woo-hoo! Hey, did you know that a sentence has 6 words in it? Did you know that a paragraph has 5 sentences in it? And that the first sentence can also be the last sentence as long as it is reworded. In fact, this is the preferred structure of paragraphs. How do I know this to be true? My son's teacher told us. Boy, I hope my son's teacher doesn't ever read any of my blogs because I'm a rule-breaking disaster. Anyway, my wife and I went to see my son's teacher when we noticed some problems. We asked the teacher what my son was doing in class and why he might be having some difficulties, and his teacher looked puzzled. According to her, he wasn't having any major problems. But when I said, he's not looking forward to language arts class, so there must be something going on that he's reacting to. Again, she looked puzzled. When I asked for some examples about what he might be reading, she didn't give us any real literature. I said, what about writing? She put out some spelling words and some Peterson's handwriting guides. Not a very rich language arts experience, I thought to myself. I asked the teacher the big question. I was like, what's your goal? And her response? To get them ready for the state test. A big, fat smack of reality to the face. I heard a voice inside my head scream, deep breath. As a teacher educator, I have been tirelessly advocating and literally pleading with future teachers to refuse to carry out inhumane orders, you know, like teaching to the test. I had to be frank with my son's teacher. My reply was, look, I understand the situation and the pressure you are under, but I literally do not care about my son's score on the state test. I then informed his teacher briefly about the short-sightedness of the test, the time being wasted on test prep, and more importantly, the research on how fragile boys are when it comes to language arts and writing. However, in the world of accountability and high-stakes testing, as I stated earlier, sentences have 6 words and paragraphs have 5 sentences, and good paragraphs have an opening sentence that is reworded as the closing sentence. How did I come to find this out? My son's teacher, of course. She actually asked my son to take out his last writing assignment and asked him to read the writing prompt. The prompt? Write about your most favorite time ever with your family. My son's assignment started, "Woohoo! Let me tell you about the best time I had on vacation." His teacher looked at me and said, "Woohoo is not a sentence. And his first sentence doesn't have 6 words. And we didn't ask about the best time with his family. It's obvious my son has no ability to write or follow directions. What writer would try to show excitement? Woohoo? Didn't he read the prompt? It specifically asked for the best time with his family. I could go on and on, but I think I made my point. Yes, my wife and I are personally upset with my son's teacher. However, should we be? She's just doing what's expected of her. She follows the curriculum maps verbatim. She's making sure that the low-paid test scorers are able to quickly read students' paragraphs and score them appropriately. This is why I despise the so-called high standards movement. After years of being told what to do and how to run her class, after years of hearing about the possibility of being fired when her kids fail to be adequate, after years of this, is it even possible for her to see the damage being done? In the end, I'm not mad at my son's teacher. She's just a product of the culture, a sad culture designed to create mass failure, failing students, failing schools, and failing teachers. Woo-hoo.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Is there anywhere on earth where these insane standards are not being applied? I bet Matt Damon's mom knows.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Matt's mom, you've been all over the world, I'm sure. But have you been to New Zealand?
No, but I'd love to go because I heard that they just got rid of standards.
Yeah, can you wait a minute? They got rid of standards. And this is the part that's awesome, right? Not just standardized tests, but they got rid of standards. And you're excited about that.
I would actually like to talk about this.
Okay.
Because I feel that if people understood this one thing, we could start to really make some changes in education. See, this idea of standards came along around the time of No Child Left Behind. What standards are it's a list for every grade of the many, and for kindergarten it's 90 in the Common Core, 90 standards of specific learning outcomes that students are supposed to accomplish in the kindergarten year, specific outcomes for each subject area, primarily literacy and math. And these standards are written down and put into documents and given to teachers. They're expected to teach these standards. These are the standards that then get tested. Even teachers get evaluated by them. Even some programs get funded by them. But the whole thing goes back to identifying specific concepts, skills, bits of information that children are supposed to learn in each grade. That, to me, is the basic problem because it ignores the fact. It's basically asking every child to learn the same thing at the same time. So it's ignoring all the dimensions of the teaching and learning process that are human, that involve students, that involve their culture, their interests, their developmental levels, their unique learning styles, and all the things teachers should understand about students so that they can actually teach them. We shouldn't have any standards. We should have goals, broad goals that take into account the holistic person and the holism of a learning teaching experience, and focus educators on that and being good at that, and help them be good at that through teacher collaboration and professional development, and stop making them teach specific facts and skills that are going to get tested. It's ruined education.
But that would require us to do what New Zealand did, and I think this is the part where it's interesting. They finally, researchers and academics pushing back over a 10-year period and saying the evidence is bad, and in fact the rationale being political rather than educational was the reason why they're now saying, look, standards are bad, and people have finally understood through the use of research, teachers, and academics who pushed this finally forward to say national standards need to go.
Yeah, and it's the same thing that's happened in the U.S. It's been pushed by the politicians and not by the professional knowledge and research evidence of educators. It's been pushed by politicians. That's the whole problem. And a lot of the things kids are expected to learn, they're totally inappropriate anyway and unnecessary. So New Zealand finally figured out the evidence was there and it wasn't working, and with the help of a lot of academics and researchers who spoke out, true. But here in the U.S., we've been silenced on this. There are a lot of people who understand that these standards things are for nothing.
Yeah.
But we can't get a voice.
That's just where I, as much as I love that New Zealand got rid of national standards, what I really like is the fact that people like you, people like me, people, teachers, people who work with children were the ones who pushed enough and were finally heard. And that, for me, is a hopeful tale in telling people like us in our field, we do need to continue fighting for what we know is right. Because, look, New Zealand, they had a national curriculum, national standards, but academics pushed back, and look what happened.
Yeah, hear, hear. And that is why we do what we're doing. And it is unbelievable that after almost 20 years, policymakers, politicians are still pushing the same pointless, useless, ineffective approach.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
She is a research professor of education at New York University and a historian of education. She is the founder and president of the Network for Public Education and blogs, oh my God, she blogs at dianeravitch.net. Welcome back to Busted Pencils, and it's been a while, but welcome back, Dr. Diane Ravitch.
Thank you, Tim. Great to be with you.
Hey, so what's, before we get into this article, I mean, dianeravitch.net, how is it possible that one person is able to publish between 5 and 8 blogs a day?
Well, I'm mostly regurgitating what other people have written, which I find impressive, and I've tried to use my blog as a platform to expand other people's voices, to give them an opportunity to get to a national audience. And very often, the pieces that I post are picked up by reporters all over the country, so that occasionally it makes a difference. I frequently write my own articles. The EdSurge invited me to write about technology and the risk of technology, or maybe I proposed to them it should be the risk and not the rewards, because EdSurge is devoted to technology, and I decided it would be an opportunity to go right to the tech community and warn them that if they didn't clean their own house, they were going to have a parent rebellion.
and that's what we're going to be talking about here in the EdSurge article. It's edsurge.com, and the title is 5 Risks Posed by the Increasing Misuse of Technology in Schools. And yeah, I mean, we go through these, and you've got 5 risks in ed technology. Before we hit each one, though, I mean, there's this general sense, I think sometimes an unquestioning sense, that if it's technology and it's education, then it's good for everybody and we should just get behind it. Is that an oversimplification, or?
No, I think that's actually right. In New York State last year, we had a bond issue for $2 billion for new technology. And, you know, people just said, good, everybody needs technology. They didn't realize, or they didn't think about, that there were trade-offs, that if you're spending $2 billion on tech you're not spending on reducing class size or on other things that are equally compelling, like facilities. But voters went all in for $2 billion for new tech without asking any of the questions or thinking about the problems.
Yeah, I think that we see that way too often. It's the shiny object, and we want the shiny object, and we don't realize that the shine itself is the distraction. And when we get beyond that, we look and go, wow, it could have invested better money. But, you know, that's kind of the world we are in, and people typically want to fix education as if it – first of all, we always have to assume what needs to be fixed. But if ed technology is going to be helpful, which you point out in the article, that you're not against technology because we all use it, but there are risks. And so let's talk about each of these risks. Risk one, the threat to student privacy. What does a parent need to know about that?
I think the most important thing that parents need to understand is that every time their child uses technology in school, they are linked into a vast global network where every click is being entered in somewhere, and an algorithm is picking up all the information. Kids enter a lot of personally identifiable information. It's going into a cloud, and this information will be used to market their personally identifiable data. And so much of this invasion of privacy is not about education. It's about marketing. It's about product. It's about developing new product that can then be marketed back to the students and back to the schools. And why in the world should we spend billions of dollars to allow companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook and others to develop product to sell to us? It just doesn't make any sense. What we should be focused on is what do the children need? What do the students need, and how can they learn better? How can we enrich their educational experience? And technology can do that, but at the same time, we have to realize we're in a wired world, and everything that they enter in is going to be stored somewhere for use by somebody that we have, and we don't even know who they are.
Well, and a lot of that usage, that data tracking that they're using is actually for marketing purposes, is for some other technology that maybe, but usually is not even education related as much as it's related to just consumerism, I would say, for a lot of these data collection devices.
Right. Well, the thing to understand that these people don't is that data collection is ubiquitous, and the people collecting the data are not educators. They're in tech, and the most chilling video I ever saw was a statement by the president of a company called Newton, K-N-E-W-T-O-N. I believe it's owned by Pearson. And he said, laughingly, "We know more about your children than their parents do." That's a scary thought.
Yeah, nothing to laugh at. And so for the listener, you know, particularly dig deep into, and Diane points this out in the article, the In Bloom fiasco in 2014 with a $100 million grant from the Gates Foundation. Luckily, they're not around anymore, because as you point out here, there's a happy end to the In Bloom story.
Well, In Bloom had gotten $100 million, mostly from Gates, but also from the Carnegie Corporation. And they had an agreement with seven states and a group of districts from across the Midwest that were going to literally turn their data about children's personally identifiable information over to In Bloom. It would be put into a cloud. The cloud would be managed by Amazon. What would happen to the data is that it would become commercially become available for data mining, for commercial operations. There were two parents in particular, Lainey Hameson in New York City and Rachel Stickland in Colorado, and they got together and they organized parents across the country, specifically in those states, in those districts, and they raised a ruckus with the legislature. And, of course, the legislators had no idea what was going on. But when the parents began turning out in force, the states withdrew. The last state to withdraw was New York State, and In Bloom collapsed because it had no customers anymore.
Well, there's give us some credit, because resistance is not futile sometimes when parents decide to come together. Let's go on to risk two. And this one has become almost, I mean, you just hear it and people go, of course I'm for this, personalized learning. And you say, let's be careful, it's proliferating. What is it about personalized learning that we need to be concerned about?
Well, the bottom line with personalized learning is it's not personalized at all. It's simply an algorithm, and a student gets on a computer and answers a question, and then if you get it right, you go on to the next question. If you get it wrong, you go on to a different question. And so the computer makes an adjustment based on whether you're right or wrong, and they call that personalized learning. Well, there's nothing personalized about it, because there's no person involved except for the student. There's no teacher involved, and it's a way of... It's a hoax, because it's depersonalized learning. And I frequently on my blog will say, don't ever believe the term personalized learning. This is depersonalized learning. It's turning students over to a machine and letting the machine adjust for the level of difficulty of the question. But it's basically standardized testing, which is not personal at all, that is tied into an algorithm. And then they call that personalized learning. And so what you have to be aware of, and what parents and teachers have to be aware of, is that this is machine learning, and we've had different efforts to impose machine learning, computer-based instruction for many, many decades, but no one has ever had the chutzpah to call this personalized learning. So don't be fooled by the term.
We are talking with Dr. Diane Ravitch, and we are looking at her new article in EdSurge about the risks of ed technology. We are talking to the eminent scholar historian, Dr. Diane Ravitch. We were talking about the risks associated with ed technology, and we had just gone through personalized learning, and we're going to move into risk three. And risk three is one I don't think people think a lot about, Diane, but this idea of how technology can be used for assessment, but maybe more importantly, how improperly it can be used.
I think the risk with technology and assessment is that it is inevitably standardized. If you write your answer to a question, if the teacher writes a test and you write the answer to a question, you may go off on a flight of fancy. You may demonstrate creativity. You can demonstrate imagination. There are all kinds of ways you can show that you've not only mastered the material, but you've thought about it and that you've reflected on it, that you've brought some thoughtfulness to your response. With assessment-driven technology or assessment that is done by technology, the answer is yes or no, right or wrong, pick one, two, three, or four. And if it is a handwritten, or not handwritten, but if it's a typed out essay, it's graded by a machine. And there have been studies done at MIT that show that you can put absolute gibberish into the answer, and it doesn't matter. There's a guy there who recently retired, named Professor Les Perelman, and he showed how you could say that the Civil War took place in 1910. Mm-hmm. And the machine doesn't know that. So the machine will accept a wrong answer as part of your essay, because it can grade the structure of the sentence, but it cannot grade the truth or the falsity of your answer. So it's a very bad way to assess anything, because it represses what you really want, which is critical thinking, mm-hmm. and B, it can take false answers and call them correct.
Well, I was just thinking about that. I mean, imagine the idea that, first of all, you can fool it with false answers. Then the idea, though, particularly when we talk about writing assessment, the idea how, if it can't even gauge for accuracy and say, like you just said, historical data, how in the world does anybody believe that a machine can accurately gauge creativity, the use, you know, things like that? I think people just take for granted that machines are much more or smarter than we really think they are.
Well, they're still machines, and so you can give it can judge the sentence structure, and the sentence can be totally nonsensical, and the words can be nonsensical. But if the structure is right, then the machine will find it right. And as far as creativity goes, forget about it. If you were E.E. Cummings, if you were any number of brilliant thinkers, the machine would say that your sentence structure was wrong and you would be a failing student.
Well, one of my original blogs for Huffington Post was based on my opt-out push from my son when he started a sentence for a paragraph with woo-hoo, and his teacher told him, darn it, that will be marked wrong if you do that. Who knows what a computer would have done when it would have seen woo-hoo?
Oh, it would not have accepted that answer for sure.
Right. Okay, risk four. Now, here's where we're really seeing this, and there's a lot of damage being done, but the cyber charter school.
Oh, the cyber charter school is perhaps the greatest scam in education today. And in every state, the cyber charters are the worst schools with the lowest graduation rates, the highest dropout rates, the highest attrition rates, and they're very profitable. And in Ohio, it's the leading cyber charter is called the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. It's a total scam. It's now being sued by the state of Ohio for $60 million because they inflated the attendance. And it's, you know, a child with a computer at home can log on and not participate. And the ECOT, as it's called, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, will say, but their computer was on. That's class participation. No, but that's not. In California, the lowest performing school in the state is the cyber charter. In Tennessee, the lowest performing school is the cyber charter. And this is true in state after state. It's a ridiculous hoax and a giant waste of money. And in most states, perhaps even all states, I'm not certain, the cyber charters get the same amount of money as if the student were attending a school that had custodians and librarians and social workers and the whole, and they don't provide anything.
Well, yeah,
they just provide a computer.
Think about what you just said there. I mean, they're getting the same amount of money from taxpayers, and as we say, you know, these places don't have brick and mortar, they don't have teachers, they don't have libraries, they don't have the cost of the physical maintenance of the structures, but yet somehow we've created laws in which, quote, a cyber charter school can get the same amount of tax dollars. I think maybe that's the other way we should be talking to more of our neighbors. It's the way I like to say about it is that you're paying for these things, and I don't know how many people realize that what they're paying for and what they're getting are not the same thing.
Well, in the case of cyber charters, it's all about money. It's all about profit, and it has nothing to do with educating children. And I think that we shouldn't be talking to one another. We should be talking to taxpayers about what a ripoff these so-called schools are, because they're not schools. They're simply businesses that are very bad businesses.
Yeah. Well, all right. And so risk five, the money in ed tech.
Well, the money in EdTech is focused on replacing teachers with machines. The great thing about machines is that they never get a pension. They don't need health care. And when they stop working, you bring somebody in to fix them. If they can't be fixed, you throw them out. If you have a human being, you have to constantly invest in professional development and improving their skills. And they do. They should get a pension. They should get health care. They're much more expensive than machines. So the reason that EdTech has attracted so many entrepreneurs is because the holy grail of profit these days is replacing teachers with computers. And that's why so many people and companies are drawn to this.
That's the one there, too, for me as a dean of a school of education and preparing future teachers. And I try to talk to people about this. And I typically, though, Diane, will get the, you're just guarding your own profession. You're trying to make sure you keep yourself employed when you put out these dire warnings of replacing teachers. And I try so many times to say, I know that's what it sounds like because that's the position I'm in, but look closely and listen to what we just said. Why is that hard for people to understand that replacing human teachers is the goal?
Well, you know, I remember when Michelle Rhee began attacking teachers and saying that teachers don't put students first. Only she puts teachers first. Only the big foundations underwriting privatization and attacking unions put children first. Well, this is ridiculous. The only way that education can be successful is when there is collaboration and cooperation amongst the students, the teachers, the families, the community. The community has to support their schools. The families have to take their share of responsibility, because what we know from decades of research is that the families have the greatest impact on whether students are motivated, whether they do their work, and they have a far greater impact even than teachers. Teachers are very important, but families are even more important. So everybody has to work together. So when you begin to say that, oh, you're just looking out for yourself by expecting teachers to be professionals, you might say the same thing if you wanted to make a ridiculous argument. You could say the same thing about doctors. Why do you need a medical profession? Why do people who fly airplanes have to go to flight school and spend hundreds, if not thousands, of hours becoming expert at what they do? It's because we don't want to turn our children over to untrained, unskilled, inexperienced people. And if you think that children are so unimportant that they should be in the hands of tyros, inexperienced people, then that's a judgment on you, not on the profession. But behind all of this, I think, is an effort to deprofessionalize education and make it cheap. And there are a lot of people who go along with that because, first of all, they don't have children, and they would rather not pay the taxes that are required to have a decent education system.
Well, and so here we are at the end here, and we've laid out some of the cautions, and people listening might say, boy, it sounds like it's insurmountable. And I would say, Dr. Diane Ravitch, should we continue this fight?
I think that I'm glad your show is involved specifically in resistance, because I think what we've learned, and InBloom is a good example of this, is that parents make a difference. Parents and resistance make a difference, that when people get involved, when they go to the school board meetings, when they contact their legislators, they really can stop the pain. They can stop the bleeding. They can fight for education and change all of this. The one thing that I've noticed over the years since this whole so-called reform movement started, and it really took off in about, you might say, with the beginning of No Child Left Behind, which was 2002, or you might say it was with Waiting for Superman in 2010, is that whatever it has tried, this movement, to deprofessionalize teaching and to privatize schools, it's failed. It has not succeeded in Milwaukee. It has failed in Milwaukee. It's failed in Detroit. It's failed in D.C. It's failed in New Orleans. I mean, you cannot have a successful movement built on failure. And all of the programs and policies and initiatives associated with this reform movement, vouchers have failed. I mean, there have been many voucher studies that have come out recently showing that kids who take vouchers and go to religious or private schools, which are not the best schools because the vouchers are so small, but they actually do worse. They fall behind their peers in public schools. The charter schools do know better than public schools, and many of them do far worse than public schools. So you could go on with one after another of their initiatives, these so-called reformers, and it's years and years of failure. And at this point, I consider that the corporate reform movement is like dead men walking. They continue to pour money into these different privatizing and deprofessionalizing activities. And it's so stupid, and it's so wrong, and it's so contrary to everything that's happening in the really successful countries of the world, that at some point it will collapse, simply because you can only take so much failure before people say, why don't we just rebuild a good public school system?
Well, on that, make sure, the listener, you go and check out DianeRavitch.net to see everything. But Dr. Diane Ravitch, as we say here, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you, Tim, and keep up the great work.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She has served as the vice president, president, past president, chief negotiator, and building representative for the South Milwaukee Education Association. She also serves in member-to-member capacities through WEAC Region 7, as well as serving on the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's Professional Standards Council as a WEAC high school representative. She's also a 22-year veteran teacher. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Joanna Perez Risotto.
Hi, Tim.
Okay, when do you teach?
Oh, every day, all day.
I'm just with this, all these things that you're doing, all these accomplishments, I just find it hard that you're actually in the classroom, too.
Well, it's the classroom that really drives and gives me the passion to do all of that other work.
All right, so let's actually get to all of that other work, because we have some acronyms in there, and local people in Milwaukee get it, but we're talking union stuff here. WEAC, what is W-E-A-C? What is WEAC?
WEAC is the Wisconsin Education Association Council, and it's the teachers' union in the state of Wisconsin.
Okay, and so when it says WEAC Region 7?
WEAC Region 7 basically encompasses the southeast Wisconsin, the Milwaukee metro area, surrounding suburbs, pretty much southeast Wisconsin.
All right, and then the South Milwaukee Education Association is separate from WEAC?
No, it's part of WEAC. The way that it works is you have a local association. That's what the South Milwaukee Education Association is. You have your region. That's WEAC Region 7.
Okay.
And then you have the larger entity, WEAC. And then WEAC is actually then a part of the National Education Association.
All right. So now the listener has got Unionism 101, at least from the levels down, and we've got this. Now, the bigger question is, okay, you're in Wisconsin post-Act 10. We thought unions were dead.
Oh, goodness, no. Wait,
no, Act 10, Scott Walker killed teachers' unions. It's old news.
Well, we certainly are kind of limping around in certain places, but overall there really is no law or politician that can really take away the spirit of unionism.
We know, like, you can't collectively bargain, so no more wages and benefits.
Right. I mean, the collective bargaining actually is a serious professional issue.
Okay.
And technically, we can collectively bargain on base wages up to the point of the CPI index. Which really isn't much. However, there really are places in Wisconsin where teachers and their unions are really persevering because we are united through our professionalism. And when I listed off to you that there's SMEA, there's Region 7, there's so many layers of support and advocacy. But it's true, Tim. There are people, like, I will hear younger teachers, or I have former students who have become teachers, and they will say things like, "Oh, Mrs. Rosato, I can't join a union in my district because they don't exist." And I think that the message just isn't out there, that unions do exist, and you can certainly join one and are part an active unit within your school.
Well, and you know, getting away from the snide comments, let's get to the seriousness here. That's why we're doing this interview, is to make sure that people in Wisconsin realize that post-Act 10, unionism, while it may have been cut out of, quote, whatever collective bargaining rules and laws there were, the need and, in fact, your relevance might be even more important than it was pre-Act 10.
Well, and that's what I'm really feeling. I'm like, pay attention. What's happening now is the direct result of what happens when experts are removed from the equation. And so when we think about our schools and communities, and we are acknowledging things about school funding, when we hear about the lowering of standards and changing of licensure requirements, when we think about privatization and charters and vouchers, these are exactly the kinds of things that come in when there's not an equitable voice with experts guiding policy for education.
So it's not, and I think that's the piece that people forget, is that the union is also a professional body that advocates for the profession in ways that you just talked about, licensing standards. In fact, you're on one of the standards committees at the state level as a representative. These are the things that the union, in fact, maybe a lot of people lost sight of around the Act 10 hearings and didn't understand that the organization was advocating in this way for high standards for teachers in the field, for curriculum that our children get. I mean, Am I overstating or?
No, not at all. I mean, we're the people looking out to make sure that schools are safe places for students and that kids are getting resources that are developmentally appropriate. That is what a professional teachers union is actually about. You talk a lot on your show about the teacher exodus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the pieces or many of the pieces that are contributing to the exodus are also things that are a result of the weakening of teacher voice. You know, we know that salary structures that are no longer objective and transparent, you know, is part of the issue of people not wanting to come into the profession, not being attracted to it. Something else that we do and we've been doing, and this speaks to many people, is we work really hard to protect the WRS system, which is the retirement system, mm-hmm. Here in Wisconsin that's very healthy. And those, you know, that pay and benefits really are part of any profession, right?
Right.
And so I think that the teacher exodus is kind of connected to the weakening of our ability to be able to advocate for professional pay and benefits.
Well, there was just a study released today, and I'll put this on the webpage at BustedPencils.com that actually looks at Act 10 and says that at a minimum, the result of Act 10 has been a diminishing of teacher salaries and a diminishing of benefits. And so mm-hmm. the positives that we were supposedly going to get from this Act 10, they're not there. And then, as you point to, the teacher exodus. But what about new teachers, though? You talked about that. How do we get them active and activated in understanding that the union is also their professional advocacy body?
Yeah, well, I think a couple things. In general, again, I think just opening up conversations and shifting and it's common, not just within education, just in general, we've had some rhetoric for a while that unions could be bad things. I think when I connect with millennial educators in my district and in our region, they simply just don't have a lot of history around it. So I think just engaging them in that conversation. I have wondered what is done at the in the teacher prep phase, if they are getting information about that.
Way to throw it back on me.
Well, and I think the best thing that we can do is have veteran teachers and mentor teachers just really make connections and develop authentic relationships with younger teachers and spell it out for them. We have a really robust and active group specifically in South Milwaukee called Come Forward. It's actually called the Caucus of Millennial Educators. And so we see a group of young professionals who really want this to be a lifetime career, and they're willing to get educated and take action at the state level, at the national level, in order to make that happen.
So if I'm interested and I just heard this and I said, holy crap, I didn't realize I was demeaning myself by not belonging to my local union, and if I happen to be in the South Milwaukee area, where's the quickest place I can go to get information?
Well, I think anybody throughout the state, your quickest place to go for information is weac.org.
Weac, WEAC.org.
.org. Yep, weac.org. And then the thing that is probably the easiest for any educational professional is seek out people in your building. I really do think we all know who they are. We know people who are really passionate and engaged and educated about issues because they're really typically willing to share and just connect and ask.
Joanna Risotto, WEAC, union member, South Milwaukee Teacher Education Association. Thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you.
She's been a teacher, administrator, policy advisor. She's an author and a facilitator for the Family Leadership Training Institute. Angela Engel has all the qualifications needed to take on that famous Alfie Cohn question. Angela, what are the schools our children deserve?
Well, if I could paint a picture today of the kind of classrooms that our children deserve, they look very different than the ones today. They have small student-to-teacher ratios, so much more personalized learning in the way of actual real people and not computers. There's time for lunch and nutritious lunches. There's recess time. There are collaborative learning models, which, you know, what we know from 21st century learning skills are the skills where they're problem-solving in real-world context, working with actual problems that they're going to approach in the real world. There's diversity, and diversity is embraced. There's a culture of exploration and experimentation, which means it's okay to make mistakes because that's part of being innovative in the creative process. It looks like teachers, you know, being rewarded for the important work that they're doing, for having enough, you know, wages and salaries that they can pay their mortgage and put braces on the teeth of their own children. It looks like communities that are engaged and embrace those neighborhood schools as kind of the central heart place for that neighborhood. And it looks like a very interactive, vibrant place of vitality where there are partners that are parents and community and business leaders and children and educators that are all coming together for the sole purpose of what's in the best interest for children and making sure that those kids have safe and rich, vibrant atmospheres, tools, resources to create and solve the problems that are most challenging for our world.
Time now for our weekly tribute to legendary activist and historian Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
Human beings are not machines, and however powerful the pressure to conform, they sometimes are so moved by what they see as injustice that they dare declare their independence. In that historical possibility lies hope.
My thanks to Diane Ravitch, Matt Damon's mom, Angela Engel, and Joanna Rosato. Joining us next week will be Executive Director for the Network for Public Education, Carol Burris. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.